Continue in Job 29. Job is speaking about thinking about the time that when things were going so well. And this morning we looked at how significant that Job mentioned his number one joy was that presence of God and also his children being all around him. Now that was when those things were happening. Next, we want to look at Job. He lists the joy of the respect that he had got from others. I want to show this picture here. I've shown this before. This is one of one Tuket Dan, and this is the city wall that entrance of going into the city of Dan up north of in Israel, and you see where those step things are. That's where a seat would be, where a man like Job or Boaz or those city elders, those that were well-respected, would sit there, and people would come to them with things. And that's what he remembers and the respect that he had at that time when he would sit there. Let's read verse 7 through 11. Of Job 29. It says, when I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square. So this gives us a little bit of an idea what that would look like. The young men saw me and withdrew. The aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hands on their mouth. The voices of the nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of the mouth. When the ear heard, it called me blessed. When the eye saw, it approved. So here we see, you know, walking through the city, and the young men, they would step aside. They would let him pass. They showed so much respect. He had this seat here, and the older men, not just the older men, but the princes, the nobles, all of those, when they heard what he said, they were blessed. They rose and they stood. They laid their hands on their mouth. They called. They were blessed for hearing and seeing Job. That is what the people looked at. That was when God was with me, as Job says, treated with such respect. Next, we see his third source of joy was helping others in verses 12 to 17. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help and the fatherless who had none to help him, the blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and turban. I was eyes to the blind, feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. Yeah, that's as far as we want to go there. It's what God had given Job. This is the joy he had. And he shared himself with others. Those who couldn't see, he was their eyes. Who couldn't walk, he was their feet. Who didn't have a father, he was there for them. Who tried to take advantage of people, he would stop them dead in their tracks. And Eliphaz, you remember what Eliphaz said about him? Back up to chapter 22. In chapter 22, verse 5 to 9, Eliphaz says, and by the way, to me, this isn't Job answering Eliphaz. This is Job remembering what it was like when God was with him. But this is what Eliphaz said. verse 5, is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities, for you exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing, and stripped the naked of their clothing. You've given no water to the weary to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favored man lived in it. You've sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. Therefore, snares are all around you, and sudden terrors overwhelm you, and the darkness you cannot see. Eliphaz should know better. He should have known better. Obviously, Job denies this, but he doesn't state it in a way that's denying it. He's stating what he has done. And the fact that he wanted to do this is what I see here. It describes the work of a compassionate man who brought help and happiness to those that he could do it for. He strengthened those in the city, provided righteousness and justice. We're about to engage in putting on the armor of God, which is righteousness. And Paul takes that from Isaiah 59:17. Here we see this is exactly what Job has done. Take a look at verse 14 again, on Job 29:14. Job said, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. He put this on, just like Galatians 3:27, we put on Christ. But Isaiah 59:17, God says he put on righteousness, as it is said of God. He put on righteousness like a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself with the zeal as a mantle. And here we see Job has that. No wonder God said what he did about him. And no wonder this is an example for us to look at. But with all that being said, remember where Job is and what he's going through. And yet he's saying, this is back when. This is back when. He helped handicapped, provided for the needy, even defended strangers. I can't even imagine the pain emotionally that this innocent man felt outside the city gates. You ever think about that? He's outside the city gates. He's innocent. And he's been treated like this. No doubt a shadow. Job did not stop with assisting the needy. As I mentioned, he confronted the wicked to break their power. Verse 17, I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made his drop his prey from his teeth. You can see something like a hyena, I guess is what I see. A hyena, a pack of wolves, and they've got, he comes and he knocks out what this person is doing to others out of their teeth. It's the picture that's being painted. He compared the wicked to these fierce animals that were ready to devour the weak. The very thing he was accused of. In these verses here, that I just read here, verse 12 to 17. Let's see if I'm in the right place here. Excuse me, I'm looking in the wrong place with my question. Verse Let me just move on. I got notes here, but I think I put them in the wrong spot. Is it uncomfortable for you guys when the preacher's up here lost?
No.
Okay, good. Because every second seems like 10 minutes, okay, just so you know. And he not only mentions the joy and presence of God, the respect that he had, the joy in helping others, but he was also confident in the future. It was another source of joy before everything came to a sudden halt. And the reason it was a joy was because he could keep doing this for people. He looked forward to keep doing these things that he's been talking about. Let's begin verse 18. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My roots spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches. My glory fresh with me, and my bow ever new in my hand. Verse 20. It's... I am really messed up here. Okay, there I am. It was... all these things that we've been talking about that he has done for people. And he wants to keep doing it. And he had every reason to believe that he was going to keep doing it, that he wasn't going to end up outside the city losing everything and being in this condition. He saw himself as this tree planted by the waters. I shall not be moved. As that song we sing, or as we can read in Psalms 1 in verse 3. But if you would, turn to Psalms 92. Psalms 92, to me, just really is a passage that describes what he's saying here. You want to take a look. Verse 12 to 14. My righteousness flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bear fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. We know these cedars in Lebanon, huge, and the palm trees, and the roots, and the greenness, and the sap, and they're going to live a long time. That's what he thought. With his children, he would continue with all that God has blessed him with, to continue to be the eyes for the blind, and the feet for the lame, and a father for the needy. To continue to help out the widow, continue to take down those that were taking advantage of others. That's what he thought. That's what he was confident in, and the joy that he had to continue to do that. And so chapter 29 is filled with such height of his life and the happiness that he had and the joy that he had in helping others. And then his final, in chapter 29, his final source of joy was the privilege of speaking words of encouragement and help. So not only did he do things, want to do things, but he also, well, he was a Barnabas. He was a son of encouragement, as Acts 4:36 says. Let's read verse 21 to 25. He said, men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. Here he was definitely, was there for everyone. His words were encouraging. And you know how those spring rains that come down and then you go out, or maybe you sit on the porch and you can smell the freshness of it. And you know that things start to bud and the birds are chirping and that newness of life and all of those type of things. That's what he's taught. That's the way he was for people. Not just at the city gate, but at all times. He was the type that when he smiled, it lit up the whole room, so to speak, and it gave people hope. He was a leader who helped the confused make wise decisions. He was the one who gave those who were mourning and down and hurting, he gave them comfort. Gave them hope. Now, could this be news to these three guys? Could they be sitting there saying, wow, I never knew, Job? Remember, these guys traveled a long ways from three different places and wept when they saw how bad he was. Did not speak out of respect until he did, but they got out of hand. How could the town people, the people that he actually helped, how could they turn on him? Why aren't they there for him? Why is nobody there for Job? Why is the one who went around doing good now despised by so many? Acts 10:38. You see the shadows and the comparisons of Christ are all through this. All through this. And so you come to chapter 30. Now you see the words, but now, or in now, or I am. All of that in chapter 29 is gone. Job 30, the tone shifts dramatically. But now, chapter 30, verse 1, verse 9, verse 16, verse 29 says, I am. From a wonderful past, I don't know how long. I just know what verse 1 of chapter 29 says, months gone by. Job is suddenly, so he's been remembering all these things, and now he's suddenly, boom, back into the miserable, depressing, disappointing present. You can almost hear him groan. Look at verse 1. But now they laugh at me. Men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to sit with the dogs of my flock. But now, we'll get into this a little bit more. Look at verse 9. I'm reading from the ESV. It says, and now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. Job's name is a song, a byword. What does that mean? When I was putting this together, I had in mind more younger ones here that might not understand this, but you know, when you hear the name Judas, what do you think? Think betrayer. When you hear the name Jezebel, we think wicked. I know this is going to show my age here, but what do people used to say when you really got taken? They used to say you got jobbed, you got jobbed. Back in Corinth during the days of Paul, Corinthicized meant the most immoral, wicked people, just to say that name. It was a byword. You're a Job. They had it in song. Verse 16 says, "And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me." Cries out in so much pain because of the isolation. And therefore he pours out his soul there in verse 16 as one who wastes away without help. Verse 17 through 22 we'll get to eventually. And he just, it's like he's waiting for death. Verse 23, "For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living." Verse 29, Job says, he doesn't say "but now" or "and now," but he says "I am." That's the present tense. "I am a brother of jackals and companion of ostriches." Why would he say that? Why is he picking these two animals out? Why? What's the nature of these animals that Job is relating himself to? Well, for one thing, jackals and ostriches. I believe the NIV says owls. I don't quite understand that, but I don't reckon I know a whole lot about jackals and ostriches is that much, but they're not predators. They come after the predators. They're scavengers. When God says he's going to pulverize and destroy a city, what's left when he's done with it? Let me just read to you. Or you can turn to Micah 1, 6 to 9 if you would like. I'm going to read it from my notes. "For I will make Samaria," and what is Samaria? It's Israel. It's the north part. "I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I will pour her stones down into the valley. I will lay bare her foundations. All of her idols will be smashed. All of her earnings will be burned with fire. All of her images I will make desolate. For she collected them from a harlot's earnings, and to the earnings of a harlot they will return. Because of this I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked. I must make a lament like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches, for her wound is incurable." This is how Job feels. It's all been destroyed. Nothing's left but jackals. Nothing's left but these ostriches. And in fact, concerning Babylon, Jeremiah 50:39 says, "Therefore, the desert creatures will live there along with the jackals. The ostriches also will live in it. And it will never again be inhabited or dwelt in from generation to generation." Which it continues to be the case today. Saddam Hussein tried it years ago and didn't make it. This place is still desolate. This is what Job feels like now. Abandoned, deserted, all alone, left for dead. He talks about his current condition in chapter 30 in graphic detail. I hope all of you have read chapter 29 and 30 together. 29, up here. I can't help but think, when Jesus entered Jerusalem in Matthew 21, how did the people react? What's it called? We call it the triumphal entry, right? People were crying out to worship him. And as I mentioned this morning, but now, a few days later, they say, crucify him, crucify him. They slap at him, they spit on him. Okay, he was a horrible guy, wasn't he? He just healed and helped people, went around doing good. Job's lived here all his life, as far as we can tell. He did nothing wrong, and now look how he's treated. So Job looks around at God's judgment. Here's the thing. This morning we talked and began a discussion on remembering the past. I asked the question, well, I can't find it there, but a question sometimes like, if we keep looking at the past of the good things, is that going to make it even worse now? Or maybe even be uncomfortable? And it depends. But Job, it did good for him to remember these things. But he also was wise enough to know that he had to face and not deny the reality of what's going on right now. He couldn't just escape into his room and close off everything and try to write it out. He had to face it. And so Job, it's like he's looking down at himself. At the ashes, which is where he lives. And it's like he looks off into the heavens, down at himself and over to his friends and perhaps others in the town who've come out to listen. And in his deep sorrow, he compares his present situation with the past and shows how everything has changed by the judgment of God. And these five complaints correspond to the 5 points we just made in chapter 29. And you can see on the chart where they line up with, I have no respect, the first 15 verses correspond to chapter 29, 7, 11, and so on. I have no blessing, I have no help, I have no future, I have no ministry. These were all the things that he had so much joy in as he remembered the past. And now he has none of it. And in this, when you read this and look at this, you will kind of see it like this. Men, or man, has treated him bad, sandwiched here in the middle with God, who has abandoned him and who just now stares at him in indifference. Once again, men treating him bad. So what's left if you're Job? When you look those passages up and read them, that's what you see. You see man, God, man, as the reason. Verses 16 to 23 is what God has done to him. And it's man in the front and in the end. So that leaves him completely alone. I can almost hear Job saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? I cry all day, but you do not answer, and by night I find no rest. Those words can come straight out of Job's mouth and fit. We begin with, I have no respect. My voice, this is not going to hold up for me to read first 15 verses here. I hope and trust that you do that. But the young men who once stepped aside for Job are young men like those in chapter 29 and verse 8. They now mock him. They even spit in his face. At one time, Job was the greatest man in the East, chapter 1 and verse 3. Now he's made fun of in song. And to make matters worse, these men are younger than Job and their fathers. These aren't just nice little pet dogs like we think of. These are dogs. A lot of times, you know, Paul refers to those trying to undo what he taught. Watch out for the dogs. These guys aren't even worthy to sit with the dogs. And their children are making fun of me and spitting at me. Remember what before? How refreshing and how they were blessed by the things that he said and what he did and how he loved to do that. There's no respect. That respect he talks about in the first part of 30 and in the last part of 30. And he says, I have no blessing. It was before God had watched over him, or when God watched over him, when God's intimate friendship blessed his house, as we read in chapter 29, 2 to 6. And now, look at verse 16, we've read it, and now my soul is poured out within me, days of affliction have taken hold of me. Job hurt down deep to his bones, literally with a continuing gnawing pain. Verse 17, the night racks of my bones, the night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. Before Job's garment was clean, it fitted him properly. But the point that Job was making was, it's not how it looked, but what it represented. Remember, we just read in chapter 29, 14. What did he put on? He put on righteousness and justice. And now, what's he look like now? His garments disfigured, verse 18. Look at verse 18. With great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like a collar of my tunic. It's disfigured by disease. Now, there's pus oozing from his sores that make his garments stick to him and filthy and ugly and smelly. But once again, what does this represent? What does Job mean by great force that this has happened to him in verse 18? According to Job, God used his great power against him. God cast me into the mire and I become dust and ashes, verse 19. Why would Job use those two terms? What does he mean by that? Why is he using the term dust and ashes? What does Genesis 2:7 say? Then the Lord God formed man from what? From dust. He became a living being. In Genesis 3:19, God pronouncing this curse, by the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and dust you shall return. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7 speaks of returning back to dust, and the spirit returning to God. Job is literally dying and disintegrating. He is disintegrating. He sees himself as dust right in his eyes, and where is he sitting? In the ashes. It's no wonder that he says, God has cast me in mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. He is in so much pain, and never, ever underestimate all the humiliation that this man faces. And he cries to God for help. Look at verse 20. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. Has that ever happened to you from someone? I can't imagine a stranger. I know this happens all the time, but I can't imagine seeing somebody in a horrible situation looking at me crying for help, and I just... stare back. And this is God. This is how Job perceives it. Perhaps we're guilty of the same thing at times. To Job, this silence means what? He felt rejected by God himself. Job's conclusion was that God was not only indifferent to his condition, to his cry, but that he was cruel to him. Look at verse 21. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. God just stared at him and said nothing. Now Job has made the same mistake toward God that his friends did about him. He spoke words without knowledge. God's silence never gives us the right to assume anything. I was pretty happy with myself to come up with that. Only because I'm guilty of that. God's silence never gives us the right to assume anything. And I know you know the answer to this, but can you think of any other Bible character with Job's character that faced more pain, that faced more humiliation than he did, except for Christ? I can't. And I don't think that's any kind of random coincidence. Once again, I've already alluded to this, but I want you to turn to Psalms 22. Eventually, we're going to do a whole lesson on Job and Christ. We already read verse 1 and 2. Let's read it again. Psalms 22, a psalm of David, certainly fulfilled by Christ. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me for the words of my groanings? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Verse 6. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind, despised by people. All who see me mock me. They mock at me. They wag their heads. Verse 11, be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Verse 13, they open their mouths at me like a ravening, roaring lion. I'm poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. And you lay me in the dust of the earth. Verse 17. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. We see a lot of the same type of thing. Back to Job 30 and verse 30 says, my skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. We're going to cut off here. But the next time I open this study, I want to continue with chapter 30. I want to begin with I have no help. Which is where that one note I was lost on way back belongs here. It speaks of not having any help. And you know, when somebody starts to fall and you're by them, what do? You do what Eloise did and ended up in the hospital. You react to reach out and try to stop someone from falling. And Job says, I'm falling. And y'all got alligator arms. Everyone's pulled back. No help. He feels no help. Where else is there to go? In his mind. But he's learning to trust God, which is what we need to do. And even though God said he has not spoken to me like you men have, and that was true, he did say some things that he shouldn't have said, and God will chastise him on that. But it's all the things that are so amazing to me, all the different things that Job says, God uses. He doesn't just come back and answer and randomly throw all these questions out there. They have meaning to what Job is saying, but they're not answering that question. Why did this happen to me? God's just saying, you have to trust me, Job, because I did all this. I spoke this universe into existence. I can surely take care of you if you just trust me. And so we'll keep studying that and keep learning that. And now we'll sing the song, Trust and Obey. And may we sing it and concentrate on the words as we stand and sing.